So these are the suttas. This is then the word of the Buddha. What is so good about these things, what is so remarkable about these things we call the word of the Buddha, is that it almost certainly is just that, the word of the Buddha. It's not just some kind of idea that perhaps this is the word of the Buddha or some of it is the word of the Buddha. But the things that you're getting here now is with very high likelihood pretty much exactly what the Buddha said 2,500 years ago. And there is quite a bit of research that has been done into these suttas to show that that is the case. And certainly I, for one, am very convinced that this is very, very similar, very, very close to what the Buddha himself said. And of course, that, at least to me, being a Buddhist monk, is very powerful, that we are able to access these teachings of the spiritual master that lived 2,500 years ago. And they have a kind of very, for that reason, a very special place in Buddhism, because this is from the person who started off this whole thing we call the Buddha's teachings, or the Dhamma, if you like. And of course, the person who starts it off is also the most important person in Buddhism, simply because if he didn't know what he was talking about, if the Buddha didn't understand the nature of reality about meditation practice, well then, all of Buddhism really collapses if the first person didn't understand. So if there's one person that we need to have some sort of confidence and faith in, it is the Buddha himself. Because if he didn't understand, then there is really nothing here. So because of that, he has a special place. And the very first sutta I want to talk about talks basically just about that. And this is about why, if you like, the teachings of the Buddha are so important. And this is what the Buddha is supposed to have said. And this is sutta is called the Future Dangers Sutta. So this is the kind of the rationale behind this kind of meditation retreat where we do the study of the suttas. And it goes as follows. Again, in the future, there will be bhikkhus. Bhikkhus are monks who are undeveloped in body, undeveloped in virtuous behavior, undeveloped in mind, and undeveloped in wisdom. When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata is the Buddha, are being recited, that are deep, deep in meaning, world-transcending, connected with emptiness, they will not want to listen to them, will not lend an ear to them, or apply their minds to understand them. They will not think those teachings should be studied and learned. But when those discourses are being recited that are mere poetry composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by disciples, they will want to listen to them, lend an ear to them, and apply their minds to understand them. They will think those teachings should be studied and learned. And this then, says the Buddha, this is the one of these future perils that will arise. In other words, it will lead, is the peril for Buddhism, the peril for the Dhamma. The teaching basically will tend to disappear because of that. I'm not going to comment too much on this particular discourse, just to give you a flavor of what this is about. It starts off by saying those bhikkhus that are undeveloped in body, virtuous behavior, mind and wisdom. Basically, people who haven't practiced the path properly. That's what that means. Then it says that people will tend to listen to other teachers apart from the Buddha. And for those of you who don't know too much about this, this is a very big problem in the Buddhist world right today. Because the vast majority of people around the world who are Buddhist or interested in Buddhism, they do just that. They listen to disciples of the Buddha. Disciples were specifically mentioned in here. Very powerful that the disciples are mentioned. They listen to anything very often except the word of the Buddha itself. This is a very, very big problem. When I read the sutta, it's almost, wow, this is what kind of prescience, what kind of understanding of the future the Buddha had, when it was actually able to see that this sort of thing would be happening in the future. So for this reason, it is very important to get back to the suttas. And that is, this is one of my inspirations myself for taking the suttas very seriously. And so that is just by way of background. And now comes the first sutta, which really is about the theme of this retreat. And the theme of this retreat is what the suttas have to say about meditation in particular. And when I use the word meditation, I don't just mean sitting down and watching the breath or sitting down and like spreading loving kindness to the world. What I mean by meditation here is what in the suttas is called bhavana, citta bhavana. Citta in Pali means mind. Bhavana means development or cultivation. Citta bhavana is the development of the mind. And this is, I think, a much better way of thinking about meditation and just thinking about meditation in itself. Because this is a path, very broad path, about moving the mind in a certain direction, cultivating certain perceptions, cultivating certain thoughts, cultivating certain mind states like mindfulness, like one-pointedness of mind, like virtue, like a lack of anger, lack of desire, all these things. It is a cultivation of the mind in the broadest sense. And this is not restricted just to meditation practice. It's not just about sitting down and doing what we do in here just now. It's about what you do throughout the day and how you use your mind throughout the day. And it gives this idea of mental cultivation a very broad basis. You don't have to sit down with your legs cross-legged. You can do this when you walk back and forth. It is how you use your mind that this really is all about. So it's a very, very broad way of looking at this thing we call meditation. And this becomes very important. And this is one thing you will see in this very first sutta here. It's how we use the mind that is important. So this is how this sutta begins. So this sutta is called Two Kinds of Thoughts, and you will soon see why it is called just that. So this sutta opens just like most suttas. It says, first of all, thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's grove, Anathapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, and the Blessed One said this. So for those of you who may be new, the Blessed One is, of course, the Buddha, and Anathapindika's park, Jeta's grove, is one of the most famous monasteries at the time when the Buddha was around. And this beginning phrase here, "thus have I heard," the reason why that is there is because these suttas were originally transmitted orally from teacher to disciple through many generations. So "thus have I heard" is basically just a testament to that oral tradition of the suttas originally. So this is what the Blessed One said. "Bhikkhus, before my awakening, while I was only an unawakened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty, and set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty." So here we have the Buddha talking about the time before he was, it says here, enlightened. I prefer the word awakened to enlightened. To me, that makes more, has more resonance to me. You're like you're awakening from delusion, awakening from looking at the world in the wrong way, to understanding the way the world actually is. And also the word Buddha actually means just that. It means awakened. It doesn't mean enlightened. It means awakened. And one of the fascinating things, you find that in many European languages, you find the word Buddha still exists, and it actually means awake or awakened. Particularly some of the Eastern European languages, they have this word Buddha still to this particular day. So this is what the Buddha thought before he was awakened. And I always find it very inspiring when I read the word of the Buddha himself. Remember, the Buddha was just a human being, just like us. He was not a god. He was not different from us. He's basically just like us. Yes, he was very wise, and he was able to penetrate something very difficult. But essentially, because he's like us, his practice, the way he was doing things, is also a guide for how we should practice in exactly the same way. So this is the guidance that we get from the Buddha himself. And that's why I find it so inspiring to read what the Buddha did, because I think, yeah, this is how he gained his awakening. So surely I should try to follow that example, to emulate what the Buddha did. So what he did when he was, before he was awakened, he thought to himself, I should divide my thoughts into two classes. Now, a thought here is anything really that's happening in your mind. I think thought here can be understood very broadly. So anything which happens in the mind, whether it is just a perception, or it is a verbal thought, or it is like a picture, or anything which is going on, can be divided in these two ways. And these two classes are, on the one side, you have these things we call defilements. And these defilements are here taken to be of three types of defilements. So these are then the most important defilements that we have to work with. And that's why these are mentioned here specifically. And I would like to point out that of these three, the most important one to deal with is the one called ill will. This is by far the most important one. And this is because ill will, it creates so much misery for us, for ourselves, so much misery for the people around us. And also, if you want to avoid making too much bad karma, if you have, I don't know if any of you here might not really have any relationship with the idea of rebirth, but rebirth is a very important part of the Buddha's teachings. And if you want to make some maximum amount of good karma for your future life, then again, it is great to avoid this thing we call ill will. This is by far the most important one. And on a meditation retreat like this, this is the one you really need to look out for. This is the one which is problematic. Even in its most subtle forms, like irritation or annoyance or just negativity, is going to destroy your mindfulness and make you incapable of getting any further. Then there is cruelty. A cruelty, I think, is not such a good translation for this particular word. The word is vihingsa. And vihingsa is a word which basically means to harm. It's harming of other creatures. It's like being callous, being hard-hearted, like not having any sensitivity for other beings. So basically is this lack of care and sensitivity for other beings around you. And you may know the Jains, this other sect that, you know, are famous for sweeping the path before they actually walk somewhere because they don't want to destroy living beings. Well, that is kind of the height of this non-vihingsa, this cruelty as it's translated here. So you want to have a soft mind, a compassionate mind, a mind which has sensitivity to beings, any kind of beings around you. And then there is sensual desire. This is the other one, the last defilement here, which is mentioned here. And sensual desire is much more subtle and much more difficult to get rid of. Ill will is relatively easy, and I would recommend you to focus on that one. But sensual desire is also a problem in meditation practice. You will find that if you fantasize about thing, or you think about what you're going to eat, or the movies you're going to watch, or whatever sensual desire there is, it's going to be a hindrance in your meditation practice. And that is why it is mentioned here among these three thoughts. I'll talk more about these things later on as we progress. And then there is the other side, and that is called here renunciation, non-ill will and non-cruelty. And renunciation here really means the non-desire for sensual pleasures. That's really what it refers to. So you are giving up the sensual pleasures. So a thought of renunciation is like the sense that, yeah, I want to give this up because I want to be peaceful instead. I'd much rather be peaceful than crave for all these kind of things in the world. Why? Because peace is much more beautiful than craving. So this is the kind of thought of renunciation, when you understand that peace is much better than craving. thought of non-ill will, well, this is really what metta is all about, having a sense of love, compassion, and kindness for the beings and human and beings otherwise around you. And this is, again, the beauty of this meditation that the Buddha taught so much or so often in the suttas, the metta meditation, that it helps you very powerfully to overcome the ill will in meditation and any time else for that matter. And the last one, which is the thoughts of non-cruelty, well, this basically is about compassion. When you have compassion, you don't want to harm other beings. When you have compassion, you don't have hardness towards other beings. You become soft. You want to protect. You want to be kind. So these are the three positive types of thoughts. And of course, the point here, what the Buddha is saying, and this is prior to his enlightenment, that these thoughts are a problem. These other ones are leading in the right direction. And that's why he classifies them like this. And then he says, he goes on further, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, that thought subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever the thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So here you are, you can see, after having divided thoughts into two categories, the next thing to do is to then understand that these thoughts that are defilements, you have to overcome them. And this is what the Buddha, of course, is talking about here. And at the very outset here, he says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. Now these terms here, diligent, ardent, and resolute, they sound very kind of like tough almost, like resolute, ardent, you know, really kind of. But the point is that just this idea of dividing the thoughts into two classes and understanding that some of them are defilements and some of them are not, that is what is meant here by diligent, ardent, and resolute. It doesn't mean using lots of willpower, which you might think ardent and resolute means. It doesn't mean kind of clenching your clenching your teeth and sort of, you know, pushing thoughts out and getting other thoughts in. That's not what it means. It means just that you are careful, you are diligent, as it says here. In fact, the word diligent here is in the Pali is a word called appamada. It's a very important word in the Pali. You see it all the time in the suttas. And appamada is much better translated, in my opinion, as being heedful. You know what heedfulness? Heedfulness means that like you're careful, you are aware, you understand that some things are bad, some things aren't to be taken care of, and you have that sense of care and in your mind as you practice. You're careful, you watch out, and that is what this word appamada really means. Diligent to me means more like you are working really hard. But this has more to do with the care you take, you know, being moral, being a good person, being careful with how you live your life. Dania, do you want to ask something? Yeah. Yeah, I think the idea here is that it doesn't have to be thoughts of metta. It can be thoughts, for example, of equanimity, thoughts of, you know, mudita, which is like sympathetic joy. It can be thoughts in many ways. It doesn't have to be metta. But But metta is the standard way of overcoming ill will and cruelty, and compassion overcoming cruelty. So for that reason, you use metta to overcome these things, but actually it is much broader. And that's why I think the Buddha uses these broad terms. So please, if you want to ask questions as we go along, you're more than welcome to do that. Maybe not too many questions, otherwise I think we break the flow a little bit. But you're certainly welcome to ask, and I will pick you up as we go along. So my main point here is to point out that sometimes when the Pali or the language of the text seems very tough, like ardent and resolute, it doesn't necessarily mean such toughness as we normally understand it. What it means more likely is that you are careful in your practice. You are diligent in the sense that you are you reflect carefully, you understand what is right and what is wrong, and not so much that you are using lots of willpower. So that is the first point I want to make there. And then, as he abides, as it says, thus diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. This is the Buddha said he had a thought of sensual desire. Again, as I like to point out, the Buddha is pretty much like us. He says here he had thoughts of sensual desire. Later on he says he had thoughts of ill will. He had thoughts of cruelty or harming. Well, you know, that basically means he's a human being just like the rest of us. He's no different. And that is nice to know, because that means he can be an example for us. And then he said he understood thus, and this is the first part, he understood a thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. Now that may seem obvious, but it is not actually all that obvious. And the reason why it is not obvious is that sensual desire has a very, very broad spectrum. There are sensual desires which are very, very clear, you know, something very powerful arises in your mind. You have this strong craving for something, and you know straight away that this is sensual desire. But the point is, and that sensual desire, of course, you should try to overcome it in your meditation practice. But sensual desire goes very, very deep. And that part of the meditation practice, and you find this in places like the Satipatthana Sutta, is to understand the full range of sensual desire. And this is one of the things that you do on a meditation retreat like this, to understand yourself more deeply. What actually is this sensual desire? How deeply does it go? And the more deeply you understand it, the more ability you have to let it go, because the more ability you have to do something about that sensual desire. So sensual desire is just like if you sit in meditation and you have an itch somewhere, or you sit in meditation and you feel a bit of pain and you move, or you do almost anything, any kind of movement you have of the body because the body is not comfortable or something, that is part of this thing we call sensual desire. It's a very, very broad category. So this is one of the things, it's actually to learn on a retreat like this what sensual desire really means. It is very broad. So when the Buddha here says that he understands a thought of sensual desire has arisen in me, this means that he understands it fully in all its breadth, in all its width, so that he's able to abandon it completely. Only when you understand it fully can you actually fully abandon it. But for most of us, it is enough to know that know what sensual desires are there. And on a retreat like this, you won't be able to maybe understand sensual desire fully, but at least know your mind a little bit. Know a few of the things that are there and try to overcome those so you can actually improve your mindfulness and then improve your meditation practice. So even a simple thing like that turns out actually to be quite profound. And this tends to be the word of the Buddha. Sometimes a single word or a single sentence has so much meaning to it that you could actually go on a long time about that. Now the next thing the Buddha says is that he says that, and this of course is very important, sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, to the affliction of both. So here, remember what the Buddha is trying to do here, or this is actually the Bodhisattva before he is enlightened. He is trying to overcome sensual desire. So this is how you overcome it. You overcome it by understanding it is a problem. It is something that you have to abandon. And the first thing, of course, you notice here is that he's not using willpower again to overcome these things. What he's using is reflection, understanding the problem with these things. And again, this brings me back to what I was saying earlier on at the very beginning. Far too many people use too much willpower on a retreat like this, or even in daily life, because we suppress thoughts we don't like. We suppress thoughts we think shouldn't be there. But the Buddha actually says here, that is not really the best way to do it. The best way to do it is by understanding the danger in these things, understanding that it don't work, and then on that basis you abandon it. And this is, of course, the beautiful thing that Ajahn Brahm often talks about. If those of you who have heard many talks by Ajahn Brahm, you know he often talks about wisdom power rather than willpower. And this is exactly what the Buddha is saying here. Wisdom power, not willpower. It's wisdom power that takes you somewhere on this path. Willpower, maybe a little bit. Wisdom power, a lot. And that is what really works. And the first wisdom power here, and this is a very important one, this is to understand that sensual desire leads to your own affliction, your own suffering, your own pain, your own problems. And this is something that you see in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha, again and again and again. The way to understand things is to understand where suffering is, where happiness is, so you're able to classify things into suffering and happiness, because only then do you know where you should be heading, where you should be moving. So a very important part of the Buddha's teaching is to understand that distinction between suffering and happiness. Incredibly important, because only then, and this is really through personal experience that you do that, only then can you head in the right direction. And the first thing here is to understand sensual desire is an affliction. It's an affliction for me. Why is it an affliction for you? And the first thing is just right here, right now. If sensual desire arises in you, the more powerful that sensual desire is, look at it, feel what it feels like. It feels hot, it feels burning. It's something which is actually, compared to peace, if you see it properly, it's actually something that is unpleasant. And that is the craving inside of us, the thirst for pleasure. It's like a burning, it's like an agitation. It's something inside of you which is quite painful. And in many places in the suttas, the Buddha talks about sensual desire in very, very strong terms, as being dragged to a charcoal pit by two strong men and then being dumped into the charcoal pit. That's how he describes sensual pleasures. And of course, it's very hard to understand this. And that's why meditation is here for you, to start to be able to see these things for yourself. The theory is fine, but only when you start to see these things for yourself does it actually start to make any sense. So remember that sensual desire is like a burning thing inside of you. And not only that, but sensual desire eventually will lead you to do things that you don't really want to do. Sensual desire, that craving, it drives you to do things. It drives you sometimes to do acts against others that you don't really want to do. Many things, sometimes you just buy stuff you don't really need. But sometimes it causes you to commit adultery, for example. Sensual desire is so powerful that it commits you to do things towards people you really love that you never really wanted to do because of the power of that craving. So it is very, in that sense, it is also very bad, in that it actually leads to the affliction of others. And that is the next thing here. And of course, if it afflicts others, it often afflicts you too, because sometimes it is very painful when you cause suffering for other people. It's not nice, and you regret it afterwards. You feel a sense of remorse, you feel a sense of shame because you did something stupid, and you feel bad about it. And of course, it's important to understand that as long as you have sensual desire, as long as it's present, eventually you are going to follow those desires and do something which leads you in the wrong direction. It's not your choice. Restraint, holding back can only last so long. if the desire is there, eventually it will take you to do things you don't want to do. That's just the nature of desire. It's the nature of craving. And that's why it is so important to try to overcome it according to the sutta and according to the teachings of the Buddha. And of course, eventually, if you allow that sensual desire to be there, it tends to grow. You do stupid and silly things on account of those sensual desires. And eventually, from the Buddhist point of view, it also takes you to suffering even in future lives. It's bad karma, basically, if you do bad things on that basis. And then it leads to your own pain also in the future here. So this is what the Buddha means here, that it leads to my own affliction, to the affliction of others, and to the affliction of both. What does it mean, the affliction of both? Well, it means that sometimes we think that, okay, it will be painful for me, but at least I will help somebody else. Or you think, oh, I will be happy, but somebody else will suffer. I don't care about others as long as I'm happy. But the Buddha is saying it doesn't even work like that. It's not as if one person is happy and the other one is suffering. You're both suffering here. Sensual desire causes both to suffer at the same time. It leads to everybody's harm. So there's not a kind of a trade-off whether some people will be happy and others won't. It leads to the harm of everybody. And that is why, ultimately, it is a real problem. So this is how you need to reflect. It's nice to see the Buddha saying these things, but really, this is something that you have to internalize in your own life. You have to understand for yourself why sensual pleasures, why sensual craving is suffering. And only then, when you start to see it for yourself, through your meditation practice, through reflecting on this thing a lot of the Dhamma is about reflecting and trying to understand. Don't be afraid of thinking sometimes and reflecting. It's an important part of the Buddha's teaching to think for yourself and reflect. And when you understand that there is a problem, when you see that, then it becomes powerful. When I say so, or even when the Buddha says so, it is still just that. So you hear it from somebody. But when it starts to become internalized and you understand it, then it becomes really, really powerful. So try to see these things for yourself. Then it becomes powerful. And then the Bodhisattva says next, he says that it obstructs wisdom, it causes difficulties, and it leads away from Nibbana. So again, this is the way that the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, before his awakening, the way he is reflecting. This is another reflection of his. It obstructs wisdom. The Pali here is quite literally panya nirodhika. Nirodhika means cessation. Panya is wisdom. So literally it leads, it is related to the cessation of wisdom. So when you have sensual desire, wisdom is no longer there. Wisdom is thrown out of the window. These two are like contradictory things. They're mutually contradictory here. You cannot have wisdom and sensual desire at the same time. You either have one or you have the other. So remember that this leads away from wisdom. It leads to the cessation of wisdom. And again, to be able to see that, you have to reflect in your own life. How does sensual desire actually work? And the way it works is that it distorts the way that you look at the world, the way you look at people around you, the way you look at things. Things which are not necessarily beautiful become very beautiful with sensual desire. Things you don't really need to buy become necessary because of sensual desire. Things that, anything gets distorted through the lens or through the defilement of sensual desire. So notice that, look at that, and you will see that that is very true. The more powerful the sensual desire is, the more distorted is your vision. And the way to see that is to compare how you look at the world when you have that craving and how you look at the world when you don't have the craving. Look at the difference, and then you will see that there is a distortion in outlook when the craving is there. And even if it's only a tiny little bit of sensual desire, it will lead to a tiny little bit of distortion. And you cannot have full wisdom when there is a tiny bit of distortion there. So again, do you want to be wiser? Almost everybody wants to be wiser. We want to be able to understand things as they actually are. Now, the only way you're going to be wise is to overcome sensual desire. This is what the Buddha is thinking here. Again, very powerful and very strong kind of contemplation. Next one, it causes difficulties. What is the Pali term here again for this one? I can't remember now. Basically, it means that it causes like problems in the mind. It causes unease. It causes something which is unpleasant. It causes things that you don't feel good about yourself. It causes difficulties in that sense. The mind doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel at ease. Vigata is the Pali, actually, I think, which is like a sense of harm inside of you. It feels harmful, and you can feel that feeling if you're very sensitive to these things. And lastly, it leads away from Nibbana. And here, of course, the Buddha is not yet awakened. So how does he know that this leads away from Nibbana? And the way I think this has to be understood is that Nibbana here means Nibbana in a very broad sense. Nibbana in the sense of extinguishment, in the sense of peace, in the sense of a happy state. And he can see, the Buddha sees clearly, or the Buddha-to-be sees clearly that this is leading away from all these good things. Peace, extinguishment, happiness, all these things that he is actually searching for in his life. And then he says, when I considered like this, then it subsided in me. When I thought like this, these thoughts that arose, I abandoned that, I removed it, I did away with it. And the interesting thing here is that these words, I abandoned it, I removed it, I did away with it, they are often translated as very strong terms. They are often translated as, I abolished it, I annihilated it, I obliterated it, as another translation of these terms. And again, if you read these terms on their own, it sounds like somebody is really clenching their fist and saying, I'm going to use masses of willpower to sort out my mind, to sort out all these bad thoughts I'm having, all these negative things that I want to get rid of, so I can be wise and peaceful, etc., etc. That's what it sounds like. So sometimes you have to be careful with the translations and not take the words too literally. And the reason is because here you see what these words actually mean. I abandoned it, I removed it, I did away with it, means I reflected in this way, and when I reflected wisely like this, then the thoughts disappeared. It is wisdom. It is through the power of wisdom and understanding that sensual desire, ill will, and cruelty is disappearing, according to the Buddha. It's not through willpower. It is the wisdom power that is important here. And this is what this paragraph is saying. And I think for me, this is one of the most important aspects of this paragraph, is showing the importance of right reflection, of being wise about these things. So be wise, and when you are wise, that is when the problematic mind states disappear completely and absolutely by themselves. So this is one of the things I would like you to contemplate, because what that means is that essentially, if you are the kind of person that tends to indulge in sensual pleasures, or you're the kind of person who gets angry, or the kind of person who maybe has thoughts of harming or whatever, you realize that the reason you have that is because you're not really reflecting wisely. There is another way of reflecting, another way of looking at the world, which makes you abandon these things and actually have thoughts that are wholesome, metta, kindness, compassion, and renunciation instead. And it's up to you to develop those thoughts by practicing the path that the Buddha taught. It's not easy, because our habits are so strong, our way of looking at us so ingrained, but the Buddha is saying it can be done. And this is the promise of this particular sutta right here. So I will read one more paragraph here at least, and I will next, I will skip one paragraph and read the next one instead, because I think the next paragraph actually comes after the one which I'm going to read. So then we come to the paragraph at the bottom of that page, which is a simile. No, I'm actually getting ahead of myself now. Then, first of all, I'm going to read the next paragraph, actually, because the next one is about ill will and cruelty, which then is treated in exactly the same way here. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me, a thought of harming arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of harming and also of ill will has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It makes wisdom cease. It causes all kinds of painful difficulties and annoyance in the mind, and it leads away from Nibbana. When I considered thus, that thought subsided in me. Whenever a thought of cruelty arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. And again, so again, exactly the same thing as with sensual desire. And I would say, as I said before, with ill will, it's even more important. But again, you can see the way to overcome ill will is, first of all, to think wisely. It's not to use force. It is not to use the power of the mind, but to think wisely. And of course, a large part of that is the metta meditation. And I'm going to get back to more of that later on. And again, also to remind you that what is meant here by ill will is a very broad category of thoughts, from the slightest type of irritation and negativity to the most severe sort of anger and hatred that you can possibly have. So it's very, very broad. The idea here is to understand these defilements in their breadth and in their depth. And to understand that the cause, I think to understand that ill will causes affliction is much easier. You know how painful ill will can be. That it causes affliction for others is also very obvious. That it obstructs wisdom again is very similar to what I said before about sensual desire. When you have ill will, your mind is all confused and you don't see things clearly. And you do things that you otherwise would never do if you didn't have that ill will. So now I'm going to come to the simile. I'm going to skip one paragraph. There's a simile on the top of the next page for those of you who have the suttas with you. And it reads as follows. So this is the simile that goes with this particular way of thinking. Just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he would be flogged, imprisoned, fined or blamed if he let them stray into the crops. So too, I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing or renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. Yeah. So there is that beautiful simile of somebody who, just like a cowherd, stops the cow from moving into the crops because he would be punished for doing that. In the same way, you will be punished, or anybody will be punished, if you allow sensual desires and ill will to arise in the mind. In other words, you are punished in the sense that it leads to suffering in the future, in exactly the same way. So that is the simile that the Buddha was teaching. And you see here, he sees in the unwholesome states the danger. The danger is the potential for suffering. The degradation is like you can see that there is something low about these states, something impure about them. You can see that in yourself. There's a sense of you don't feel good about yourself when these states arise. When the opposite states arise, you feel good about yourself. They are like high states, noble states. Understand that. Look inside of yourself. And you can see, I think, that quite clearly, that some of these states are ignoble and some are noble. They are defilements. And the wholesome states are the opposites. They have the aspect of cleansing, of purifying the mind. And that is why they are so important. They purify the mind. And for that reason, move the mind. I'll talk about this more later on, towards mindfulness and towards meditation practice proper. So I think I will stop there. That is a very dense paragraph. I just went through that. There's a lot of information there. And there's an enormous amount of things going on. But I will probably fill in more about that those particular things later on as we go on this retreat. It's already past 9:30, so I don't want to go on for too long because then it becomes too much, I think. Yeah. Okay. So, any questions before I call it an evening? Yeah. Everybody happy? Yeah. There is a box on the outside there as well. So if you have any questions, you can write them down and put the paper in the box, and then I can answer them maybe tomorrow evening or something. Yeah. So please do that if you wish. So let us just finish off the evening by paying respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.